So, good morning, everybody. New week, new topics. Before we start to look into new algorithms for computed tomography, let's briefly summarize what we have considered so far. Good morning, sir. It's a beautiful Monday. We are all highly motivated. We like to learn. We have 4 weeks, or we just have 4 weeks for Christmas. And we have learned a lot so far. We talked about acquisition, specific image enhancement. So we looked into the acquisition devices that are used in radiology departments. We looked at the principles that are used for building the sensors, for acquiring the images. And we found out that certain artifacts are a consequence of the mechanical, electronical setup of the device. And we have seen several acquisition-specific pre-processing algorithms. In terms of math, we have seen in this context the concept of least square estimators. The least square estimator to minimize a parametric function that was set up by using a least square estimator. In the second part now, and that's where we are in currently, we look into the problem, given multiple images, how can we generate higher dimensional information out of the projections? And that's reconstruction. Hi, Stefan. We talk about reconstruction and in particular based on X-ray images. And what we have seen in this context, first, before we looked into the reconstruction methods themselves, we learned about projection matrices. And homogeneous coordinates. Just remind you that we have considered things like P times X is U, where P here is a 3x4 matrix carrying the intrinsic, extrinsic camera parameters. And it's all you need to characterize the straight lines. X-ray quanta are propagated through space before hitting the detector. Also in this context, we have used the least square estimator to do calibration. Calibration is the process to estimate P out of a set of known point correspondences. And we also have learned a crucial tool here in this context that allows us basically to solve any linear algebra problem that we are usually facing in medical imaging. Yeah, so that makes us also happy. No special lecture on linear algebra. SVD does it all. If we know about the properties of SVD without proving the properties, we can use it for rank computation, for rank deficiency enforcement, for computing inverses. And remember, 2 weeks ago, I was showing to you a singular matrix, and I said I'm gonna invert it. Then one student said, we cannot invert it because it's a singular matrix. And I said, I can do because I use the SVD. And if there is no inverse, it takes the matrix that is closest to the potential inverse, yeah, for instance. So we have a very powerful tool here, toolbox, SVD, the square estimator. We know about projection matrices. And now we look into X-ray reconstruction. And the story is as follows. We have Bayer's law. Where we integrate the function that we want to compute over a straight line. And we have seen last week the concept of filtered back projection. It's called FBP based on the so-called Fourier slice theorem. And what is the Fourier slice theorem? So Beer's law. And then we have seen the Fourier slice theorem. You can write it in terms of formulas, but for us it's more important to have the picture in mind. So if you have to reconstruct a function like this, and you project this object here by parallel beams on this detector line here, we can say that the Fourier transform of this projection is equal to the Fourier transform through the object that is parallel to the detector line and centered here, for instance, in the object center, or centered here where this is the Fourier transform space, eta and xi, and this is the zero point where we have the zero frequencies. Okay, so if you want to build up the Fourier transform of the object we want to reconstruct, you just rotate around the object, you acquire detector line by detector line the x-ray projections, you compute the Fourier transform, you put in the Fourier transform into the spatial, into the frequency domain representation of the object we want to reconstruct, and we basically get for free the Fourier transform of the object we want to reconstruct in polar coordinates. So that's the Fourier transform. And that's also why CT systems look like they look like, with this donut structure where the detector and the X-ray tube rotate around the patient. They rotate around the patient. They collect nothing else but the projection images and the Fourier transforms, and we sample the 2D Fourier transform of the object we want to reconstruct by using these projections, okay? And then we have reconsidered this in detail. We incorporated the coordinate transform. We incorporated the coordinate transform, saying we have to convert the polar coordinates here. We get it in polar coordinates into Cartesian ones, and we end up with a very powerful algorithm. And I did all the math on the blackboard last week. Yeah? So it's not very difficult, but some kind of tricky. So you should try to follow up on these ideas at home and try to do the computations yourself. Yeah? We have also introduced the concept of Dirac delta function to be able to write the line integral as a two-dimensional integral. So a lot of tricks are incorporated, but at the end of the day, we get a very basic and important result for image reconstruction. So what you should keep in mind is the CT scanners down there in the radiology department. They are just good for collecting the Fourier transforms line by line of the object we want to reconstruct. Okay, good. And I put all this on the slides as well, so you can read this. The important concept, once again, we are repeating ourselves over and over again. Fourier transform, inverse Fourier transform. That's something you know by heart now. Yeah? Whether there is an integral or the discrete version with a sum, you immediately see, okay, that's the Fourier transform, and we can deal with it. Then, the convolution theorem, once again, if you convolve a signal with the kernel G, this is the integral that we end up with, and the convolution theorem tells us the convolution in spatial domain corresponds to the product in frequency domain, and vice versa. And the product in spatial domain corresponds to the convolution of Fourier transforms. That's exactly the same argument. Yeah? I usually use this as a homework exercise problem because you can't find it with Google the other way around. It's just switching things around. Okay, good. We also did the proof on the blackboard. And now we have to introduce another transform that is very important for us in the future. That's the so-called Hilbert transform. Is there anybody in the audience who has heard about Hilbert transform? Really? Where? Nachrichtentechnik, okay. That's the place where you should, yeah, that's the place where you should hear about these things. I never heard about these things before I did CT reconstruction. And then you know that the convolution can, the Hilbert transform is defined by the convolution with a function 1 over pi tau. Yeah, and you plug it in here and convolve the signal with f using this convolution kernel. And the nice thing is that we can write the Fourier transform of this kernel in a very compact manner. It's minus I sine double or sine omega. Yeah? That's the Fourier transform. So that's the pair spatial domain Fourier domain or frequency domain representation of the Hilbert transform. Yeah, so this pair is very important. So we have h of tau is 1 over pi tau and h of omega is minus I sine of omega. We have to use it later on to derive another type of reconstruction algorithm. That's the Hilbert transform. And now the central slice theorem. Once again, that's the figure of the figures that you should be able to draw within the oral exam. We have our object, fxy. We have our detector line. The detector elements are indexed by S. The second parameter characterizing the detector line in space is the rotation angle. And if I compute the Fourier transform of the projection, I can find the Fourier transform in the Fourier transform of the object I'm looking for on the parallel line that goes through the origin in the frequency space representation. Okay? That's the picture. Now you say you're explaining this 500 times now. It's still amazing how many students show up in the oral exam that cannot explain this idea. So I'm explaining it over and over again. And you guys sitting here in the lecture, you can burn it into the outer shell of your brain because that's the space is for, yeah, for those important things. Okay. That was a joke. Yeah, last time then we looked at the Fourier transform of the projected signal and that it corresponds to the Fourier transform at this point. I did all the computations so you can fill in all the formulas. And what we do is for reconstruction, we rotate around the object and collect the Fourier transforms. And the fact that our detector elements are indexed by S equidistantly, that means that all the points with S is 1 are sitting on a circle, S is 2 sitting on a circle, so you get these concentric circles where the points, the sample points sit on. So you have a polar coordinate representation saying this is the rotation angle and the distance from the origin in the or represented by S. Okay? And the simple idea is compute this, measure this. This can be measured. Compute the inverse Fourier transform, and we are done with reconstruction. And now filtered back projection. What we did is we incorporated the coordinate transform by using the polar representation, and we ended up here with a Fourier transform, and we were able to show, and that's what I did last week on the blackboard, that this can be written by a convolution of a filter kernel with the projection. Do you remember what was the filter kernel that we have used? I heard it. It's the absolute value of omega. Yeah. So we had here, let me just draw this again. So here are our samples. Here are our samples, and we have looked at the Jacobian of the transform in polar coordinates, and it turned out that the Jacobian is omega absolute value.
What is omega?
Omega, that's the frequency that we are considering. We look at the at the polar coordinates. So if we represent here a line by a point by the angle theta and the length omega here. Yeah? So if I have an omega theta pair, I can compute the x-coordinate and the y-coordinate by using omega times cosine theta y omega sine theta. So omega is basically the length, the scaling factor for the polar coordinate in this representation, not the frequency. Okay? It's not nice. We should better call it S, by the way, because we have represented P theta S. Okay, so if you have a pair, omega, theta, omega, then you can compute the xy coordinate in space by using just elementary trigonometry. And the Jacobian is defined by compute the partial derivative with respect to the first component. And the second column is compute the partial derivative with respect to the second component, the second parameter. So it's theta. The cosine goes down, so we have minus sine theta cosine theta as derivative. And this is multiplied with omega. Yeah, and then you use the property that sine square plus cosine square is 1. And you end up exactly with the absolute value of omega. And if you draw this, omega absolute value, you get this V structure. Yeah? This V structure. And we found out that the Fourier transform of the projected signal is multiplied with omega absolute value. And the multiplication in frequency domain corresponds to convolution in spatial domain. So we have to convolve the original projection basically by using the inverse Fourier transform of omega absolute value. And does omega absolute value make sense? This is the weight of the Fourier transform samples, and it's clear the closer we get to the center, the smaller the weight should be, because there the sampling points are getting denser and denser. And the far away I'm from the center, the sparser the samples will be, and the more impact the samples should have on the result. And this intuition is exactly characterized by the math we are doing here, by incorporating the coordinate transform. Believe me or not, one second, if I ask students in the oral exam, can you draw the absolute value of W or S? 50% cannot draw this function. Yeah. And you know how I feel after having observed that you cannot draw this function that my son can draw. And okay.
Do we consider negative values of omega?
No, we look at the absolute value. Well, look at the representation. I mean, if you have polar coordinates, so you have your angle, and then you have your scaling factor, omega. Yeah, and if omega is negative, you get for this angle points down there. So you can decide either your theta goes from zero to pi. And you have positive values, and positive and negative values, or your theta goes around and you only consider positive values. It's your decision. Yeah? Okay. So this here corresponds to a convolution in the spatial domain. And we have seen in the formula that there is an e to the power of 2 pi something that was the inverse Fourier transform. So we filter the incoming signal with the inverse of, we convolve the incoming signal with the inverse of this one here and end up with a function that has to be integrated from 0 to pi. From 0 to pi. The convolution result has to be integrated from 0 to pi. And that's exactly what we do in computed tomography. We filter the observation, and then we take all the filtered observation and integrate them up for all the rotation angles. So we smear the filtering results over the slice we want to reconstruct. And that's the so-called filtered projection algorithm. Now we can rewrite the filter omega absolute value by using this trick here. I mean, that's an alternative way of writing omega absolute value. Let's check for that. So we have omega is 2 pi I omega 1 over 2 pi minus signum or sine of omega multiplied with the imaginary component here. We forget about the 2 pi. I times I is minus 1, so we get sine of omega multiplied with omega. Yeah? So if the omega is negative, this one is minus 1. Minus 1 times minus times a negative number is a positive absolute value of omega. And if it's positive, everything is fine. So it's an alternative writing of the absolute value using the imaginary number I here. Yeah? It looks way more complicated. That's a complicated way of writing the absolute value. And what is it good for? Well, if we remember, let me just go back to the, I have it on the blackboard for a good reason. If we look at the Hilbert transform, look at this minus I sine W. Minus I sine W. Ah, here he's coming now with the Hilbert transform. Yeah? That's the idea. That's the idea. So a multiplication in frequency domain using I minus I sine omega is the Hilbert transform. And this is equivalent to the convolution with 1 over pi s in the spatial domain. Yeah? And the other thing is if you look at the Fourier transform of a derivative, yeah, for derived function, you end up with an additional prefactor 2 pi I omega. If you compute the Fourier transform of a function, and if you compute the Fourier transform of the derivative of the function, the two Fourier transforms are related to each other by here this prefactor here, Fourier transform and inverse Fourier transform. What is the difference between Fourier and inverse Fourier transform? It's just the sign, yeah? It's the sign in the exponential function that flips. Yeah? What you should remember is the inverse Fourier transform is as simple as the forward Fourier transform. Just switch or flip the sign, okay? And once again, it has to be simple because I understand what's going on there. Yeah? So that's always what you should keep in mind. And now, how can we use the differentiation Hilbert back projection algorithm? What we compute here is we compute the derivative of the projection with respect to S. So we compute the first derivative of the projection with respect to S. Then we apply the Hilbert transform to it. That means we convolve the derivative with 2 pi square over S. And then we have the convolution result. And then we just integrate over all the rotation angles. That's an alternative reconstruction algorithm that we can apply here. And in literature, there are different back projection algorithms. They are summarized here in the table. So what you can do is you can apply a 1D RAM filter with Fourier transform. You can, and back project, you can compute the derivative, apply the Hilbert transform, and back project. And now you can switch back and forth by using the rules of integration, multiplication, commutativity, and things like that. And you can analyze from a numerical point of view what is more robust if you first apply Hilbert transform, or compute the derivative, the Hilbert transform, and then back project, or apply the RAM filtering in frequency domain, do the inverse Fourier transform, and then do the integration, the back projection. There are different ways to do this. And from an analytical point of view, it's all the same. Yeah? From a numerical point of view, it's very interesting what's going to happen. Because if we have numerical methods, and if we have noisy data, and if we do measurements, we have noisy data, it's interesting to see how the noise affects the reconstruction methods over the different steps we are using. For instance, would you imagine that the Hilbert type of reconstruction is more robust with respect to noise? What's your intuition? So, see, the Hilbert reconstruction, think about that while I'm wiping the board. Ludwig, how was your weekend? Great. Please explain. Okay. You know what the right answer would have been? I was using MATLAB to all the reconstructions. I generated sinograms. Okay, good. The idea with the Hilbert transform requires computations of derivatives. And the computation of a derivative requires to compute something like fx in the discrete. That is, for instance, fx minus fx minus 1. Yeah, that's the central approximation of the differentiation. Now you are not happy with it. Let me just explain. This here is the limit h to 0 fx minus fx let me just rewrite this. It's always the same trick. You have seen this hundreds of times, I'm sure. Minus fx divided by h. And if we use h to be 0 in the discrete, you blow it up because you have to divide by 0. So you have to use something that is close to it. So let's use h is minus 1. And if you plug in h is minus 1, you get fx minus 1. Yeah? So that's the closest you can get to the derivative. And now assume that the signal here, the signal fx, is the ideal signal at position x plus some noise. Yeah? So you have some random noise here. You add something up. And now it can happen that here you add something up that takes the maximum positive value. And here at this sample, you add something up that has the maximum negative value. And then you add these two and you double your error. Yeah. So differentiation is something where the alarm bells in your brain, in your ears, are ringing. Because differentiation means you combine, you add up, or you subtract, you combine two noisy values. And if you combine two noisy values, you are enhancing the noise level. Yeah? So if we all have smart student friends, yeah? They tell you always how smart they are. And if some smart student friend approaches you and tells you, I found out a way better algorithm for doing this and that in image processing than we have ever seen in lecture. But it requires the fourth derivative. And I can show you on an analytic way that this is the best thing you can do. You would say, oh, you appear to be smart, but the fourth derivative means to compute one difference, a second difference of the difference, a third difference. That means you're really increasing the noise level by combining these things. Yeah, you're really increasing the noise level. So the maximum you should accept is the second order derivative, but consider this very carefully. Yeah? The higher the level of differentiation is, the more noise you get in. Yeah? And this tells you that you have to be careful with the Hilbert approach where you compute the noise, because where you compute the derivative, because you affect the noise level of the signal that you go into the reconstruction. So be careful. Yeah? Let's write it this way. Caution. It can be deadly. Yeah? It can be deadly. Be careful. Good. While preparing the lecture, I also noticed that the link to the book is a dead link. We have to fix that, yeah? I'm not sure whether you have noticed this too. Maybe it was only dead when I was looking at it. Huh? Yes, please.
Some slides ago, you wrote, now we apply a Hilbert transform, and then it was looking like 1 over something b
hoch
2.
Yeah.
So y hoch 2.
Here 2 pi square. I have to think. Here you have to multiply with 1 over pi s. 1 over pi s. And here you have the 2 pi. So you have 4 pi. 4 pi. You have the 2 pi. Yeah, I have to write it down in detail. I'll do this now with the risk that I end up somewhere. So what you have to compute is this here, it's wiped away, omega times pi. And we rewrite the omega absolute value by 2 pi I, 1 over pi I. And this is here in the spatial domain. So we go back into the spatial domain. So we have to multiply the original function with 1 over pi omega. And somewhere there must be the square in it. I'll add it to the slides, then you can follow on this. Okay? Good. Not good. I'll put the derivation on the slides. Then you have it. And now let's look at a few practical examples, including also the discrete approximation of the ramp filter that we have to apply. The omega absolute value. That's what we consider. If you look at the 2011 slides, there we have the derivation in detail on the slides. But I'll add it also to this set of slides here. The question is how to implement a parallel beam algorithm, and we will also now look into the complexity, the computational complexity. Where are the computational engineers in the audience? Who is studying computational engineering? Oh, so you're my candidate to think about the computational complexity, okay? Okay. So let's look at the second most simplest object we can reconstruct. The simplest one is a point. Yeah, the point we have already considered, and we have seen the sinogram and all this. Now let's look at a disk. Yeah? So we want to reconstruct a circle, a disk, filled with material of attenuation rho. And the disk has the radius r. Who in the audience can tell me how the projections look like that we end up with? Do you have an idea if I x-ray the disk from various directions? Yeah? Same? Well, yeah. I mean, if you have this situation here, That's the circle. And you project the circle. I mean, what you get is you have the zero here, and then you have a smooth start, and then it goes down again, and then you are.
Should we take the other way around? Because the value should be lower where.
Yeah. I mean, what are we talking about here? Yeah. And whether you put the minus here or there, that doesn't matter. Yeah, doesn't matter. Okay, so this is again your hand waver. It's a for the principle to think about the principles. You should not. I mean, if you end up looking at the signs, you are lost in details. You lose the big picture. I mean, you can do all the things using math, but for growing a good intuition, it's better to have always pictures in mind. And a brilliant student should have the three eyes. I'm repeating myself. You might have heard about this. What we are going to teach you here is not theory in a way that you just reproduce what I tell you. Yeah? Once again, you're not here to learn things that you just reproduce to make me happy and to pass the exam. What we want to do, or what our mission here is, we want to push your creativity. Yeah, and how can you be creative? Of course, you have to be intelligent. So your intellectual power should be present. I mean, that was proved by the Bavarian system and all the other systems you are grew out of. So it's selective. And here, you are the selected ones. And I'm here to relieve your, and to release your creativity, and the intellectual constraint should be fulfilled. Otherwise, you screwed up the system where you came out. Some people make it, like me. That was also a joke, a recorded joke. The second is you have to really grow a good intuition. Yeah, I mean, when I was a student, I personally had not the arrogance to say I just step one step back and I ignore all the difficult math and I'm a free thinker, and I have the arrogance to say maybe it's not good how people have solved it so far, maybe there is a better solution. Yeah, that's what researchers do, always ask questions, reconsider the solutions, reconsider statements that have been made before, and come up with new ideas. And for that you need a good intuition. Yeah? I mean, haven't you had the feeling that you are sitting in a pub with a beer and you are thinking, I mean, this derivation the guy did today in the lecture, it was okay, but it's so complicated. My intuition tells me there is a simpler way to show this. And then you go back home, and instead of having another beer, you go back home and you do the proof. Yeah, because you had the intuition. Yeah, so you have to resist the second beer, go back home and do the proof. So you need a good intuition, yeah, which way you should look into. And you should be, and you have to be equipped with all the tools, of course, but a good intuition. And what you also have to have is a good imagination. Yeah, you look at things and you have a good picture in mind, and you have a good intuition, and then you push things forward using your intellectual power. Yeah, these are the three I's that Feynman or Einstein, I don't remember exactly, they were proposing. This is the important thing researchers and engineers have to be equipped with. Yeah, and I would say an A is also required, some kind of arrogance in the positive way. Yeah, saying maybe I can do it better. Yeah, that's also something that you really should have as an attitude. Maybe I can do it better. Yeah, and I love students in the oral exam telling me, you did it in the lecture, but I have a better idea to show the same thing in two lines. Yeah, and you required 25 lines on the blackboard. Sometimes this happens. Yeah, so. Good. And it's not cut off, folks, yeah? So there is an extension here. It's not cut off. So that's the projection. How does the sinogram look like? What's your imagination, intuition? What is this? How does the sinogram look like? Will you see a sine function? Yeah, it's the structure of the sinogram will not be like this. Yeah, it will be very well shaped like this. Yeah. So if you look at the object here, and that's what you were actually meaning, I guess it's the same all over the place. You will get the same bump. Yeah, let's call it bump. And here, you will get the same bump. So all the projections look the same. And if you look at the theta s, you have your value coming from zero, then it's getting larger, 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 and then it's getting weaker. Well, I can't do that. But basically, you get a sinogram that is very homogeneous. There is nothing going this way like the points jumping up and down last week that we have considered. So the sinogram is as boring as it can be. Yeah, it's very boring. It's the most boring sinogram you can think of, the second most. The sinogram for an empty object is nothing, yeah? That's the most boring, but this one is very, very boring. So it's the same for all the projections. Good. Now the question is, if the projection is the same for each theta, you can just forget about theta. So it's independent of theta. And if you look at the length of the ray that goes through the object for different s values, you just use the definition of the sphere or of the circle, and you get here the length you have to walk through, weighted by, and this should not be a pi, this is a rho, yeah, by the attenuation coefficient. And if you are outside of the radius, that means the ray does not hit the circle, and so no attenuation takes place. Okay, so we have here the artificial projections independent of theta computed. This here is the projection dependent on the distance. For S0, we are going right through the object, so the length of the beam that goes through the object is 2 times r. Let's check whether this is plausible with this formula. S is 0, so we have r squared. The square root of r squared is, even for computational engineers, it's still r if r is positive. And we have it twice, weighted by rho. Okay? Weighted by rho. So the formula is right. Good. If you plot it, that's how it looks like. It's this cyclic or cyclic structure. And these are the entries of the histogram. So you get this for all the lines for the different angles. I should, by the way, have it the other way around here. For all the angles. So what do we have to do? We have to apply the filter to the projection that is independent from theta. Here the theta is still there, but that's the original formulation. These are the projections, and we convolve it with H. H is the inverse Fourier transform of the V function, the absolute value function. That's the inverse Fourier transform. And then we take the result and we do the back projection over all the rotation angles. Okay? Here is a typo. This should be omega, by the way. I already asked for adjusting this. So that's the way. The question now is, what is this analytically, and how can we then do the convolution? Well, we have to compute the inverse Fourier transform of omega. And the problem with the V function, I call it V function, absolute value function, is it's going to infinity, from minus infinity to plus infinity. And what do computational engineers tell me if I have a function that goes from minus infinity and to plus infinity from a practical point of view? It's bad, yeah? I mean, it will never end. So what do computational engineers do if it's never ending? What do they do?
Nothing.
Nothing. Okay, what do medical engineering guys do? They just stop at some point, yeah, and say, it's enough, okay? Intuition, imagination, and intellect. I'm not offending, hopefully. You just stop, yeah, and say, it's enough, I can't do it anymore, stop, okay? Yeah, and now you know medical engineers always do half things, yeah? Not full things, complete things. So they cut off the frequency at half, okay? They say, oh, 1/2 is enough. Yeah? It's with the beer, the same. 1/2 liter is enough. Yeah? Half is enough. Set off frequency. What? What was it, comment?
I just found out, like, thing my professor said was which I can do better.
Please do not quote me, yeah? That's critical. I don't want to read it in the newspaper, what I'm saying here. It's confidential. So we stop at some point, okay? And that's now where the hard stuff starts. Huh? You remember on Thursday I told you there are people with Siemens, with General Electric, they come to office at 8 in the morning and go back home at 6 in the evening, and they are nothing else doing but just thinking about the absolute value of omega. Yeah, and here it starts. Should I cut off at 1/2 or 1/2 plus epsilon, or should I have a smooth decay to 0? Or and what is the impact on the result? Yeah, and there are different designs for filtering. Yeah, this is filter design for reconstruction. Now, if you do this, the inverse Fourier transform. And don't ask me why do we have the square here? I don't know. I mean, it's a pain to compute this. You can look it up. Yeah? You compute the inverse Fourier transform of this filter in frequency domain, and you end up with this filter over there. That's the spatial domain representation. Now you can discretize it and compute the convolution in spatial domain. You can plot the filter dependent on S, of course. You can plot the filter and look at it. And this filter was first introduced by two Indian guys, Ram something and Luck something. Yeah, these long Indian names that Europeans cannot pronounce and remember at all. And the Western world decided to call it Ram Luck filter. Yeah, this is the Rama Ranjan Lakshrami something. Yeah, I want to be nice, but I don't remember. It's the so-called Ram Luck filter. And you find it also in scanners. Yeah. Ram Luck filtering. Yeah? Some scanners say you want to emphasize high frequencies, sharp edges, and some scanners that are over-engineered, they just say to the doctor, do you want to have the Ram Luck filter? And he should have this association with it. Ram Luck is just this sine x over x type of thing. Now you can plot it. and looks like this. Yeah, it looks like this. That's the convolution kernel that we apply. So we weight something around the center with a high value, then we go into the negative, and then we have these ups and downs in the negative. Yeah. We can discretize it for n and is an n integer, and you get this simple representation. It's the discrete version if n is even and odd. Yeah, if s is even and odd. If s is an integer, you can now think what happens if you have multiples or half multiples of integer numbers, dependent whether it's even or not. You get the sign here to be zero or non-equal to zero, and that's the way how we implement the kernel in the scanner and in our software framework. Now you might say, why should I care about this? I do the filtering in frequency domain. That's actually also what many scanners do. They take the absolute value function as the Fourier transform, and then they just multiply the Fourier transform signal with the omega absolute value over a certain domain. Yeah. But that's the filter that is used for spatial domain filtering here. That's the Ramlak filter. And please, for the oral exam, please do not learn this. At least if you are in good shape and you get me as an examiner, I don't ask this. Do you know why I don't ask this?
It's not important.
That's the usual explanation I give to people. The better explanation is? We can look it up. That's the second one. And what is the reality?
Nobody can remember it.
I don't remember it at all. Yeah? If you write it down, I mean, I might recognize this. Yeah, if I have seen it 5 times a day, I remember it. But if you come out of the blue with this definition, usually if you are outside waiting for the grade, I look it up, whether it was correct or not. Yeah. And it's not so positive if you waste your brain power for things like that. Yeah, do not waste your brain power for things like that. That's what you need to know, and where it comes from by this coordinate transform and the Jacobian. The rest is all analytics, and you can derive these things by just looking at the math. Okay? Don't waste your brain. Yeah? The negative thing is you will forget it anyways. In half a year or 10 years from now, you won't remember. But the concept might be something that you will remember. Then, again, the absolute value function, that's the V. And let's look at the approximation, the discrete approximation. And that's the red one. That's the red one. And what you see is that it's very much identical to the absolute value, far away or in a certain distance from the origin. And where the origin is here, it's not tipping down to the zero. And that's also clear to us because the zero is only required if you have an infinite number of samples. But we have a finite number of samples, and we don't want to lose the value at 0, 0 in the Fourier transform. It gets a low value, but a non-zero value. Very important. Yeah? So we Fourier transformed this and looked at this. And now let's see what happens to our homogeneous cylinder that we filter. We get here, if you have an homogeneous cylinder, you get here zeros, you get here ones. Yeah, and this is the filtering response. So it's going to the negative, it's going to the positive, and then it's constant. What is the complexity of convolution in spatial domain? It's O of n, where n is the number of samples. No, it's n. Pre-compute the filter, the the filter in spatial domain. So you have to compute the n samples. You have to compute the n samples. Then you transform the filter into the frequency domain using the FFT. And FFT is a linear mapping using this butterfly operation. You should have seen this in theoretical computer science or whatever, systems and signals. So it's on n log n. And if you forgot about the fast Fourier transform, the complexity is? You know too much. If you do the stupid way, it's Madame CE, it's a matrix vector multiplication, so the complexity is n squared. Yeah? And the fast Fourier transform just reduces one n to the log n. So we have n times log n. Then we have to do it for each projection. What do we have to do for each projection? We have to do the back projection. So we have to smear things up. Again, we have to compute the Fourier transform. We apply the filter. The filter is a component-wise multiplication in frequency domain. We have to compute the back transformation, the filtered back projection. Inverse Fourier transform, IFFT. And if you add it up, you have your filter in spatial domain, ON. Do we have to compute this all the time? No, we just compute it once before we start to reconstruct. These things are usually in the main memory in a CT scanner. They are pre-computed and available. Then also this here is usually pre-computed because the Ramlak filter does not change. Yeah, it's the Ramlak filter for all the projections. Then you have the number of projections, n log n. And basically you end up with a complexity of n log n multiplied with a number of projections. So the reconstruction complexity, that's an important message, increases linearly, and that's what I want to hear when we are having our conversation in the oral exam. The complexity of reconstruction is linearly in the number of projections. So if I use twice as much projection images for reconstruction, the complexity doubles. Yeah? What is intuitively also what we expect? Yeah? We would not expect that it's exponentially growing with the number of projections. So the more projections I have, the runtime scales up linearly. Okay? The runtime scales up linearly. The back projection algorithm, in terms of complexity, we have to initialize the function fxy with zero because we smear by the back projection algorithm the filtering results. We add it up to the function we want to reconstruct. And then what do we have to do for all the projections and for all the pixels? So we have here a loop over all pixels for all the projections. We have to compute the position on the detector element. We have to compute here the convolution and add up the convolution. Here has to be a plus, by the way. Here is a plus missing. And the overall complexity is number of projections n squared. So the filtered back projection compared to the FFT approach is a little more complex because it's n square instead of n log n, okay? So the reconstruction complexity using filter projection is the number of pixels times the number of projections. The number of pixels I want to reconstruct times the number of projections. Now let's look at the back projection example. So what we have here is one projection of a cylinder. So we have the circle, and we build up a cylinder, and we look from one side and X-ray the cylinder from one side. And if we look at one detector line, we get a signal, and then we convolve the signal with the W absolute value inverse Fourier transform. And we get this here as a filter output. And now we smear the filtering output over the function to be reconstructed. So we take the parallel projection beams, follow the parallel projection beams, and carry this value here for all the points the beam goes through, and add this value up to the accumulator field that we wanna build up, and which will be our reconstructed slice. Yeah? So I smear back the reconstruction result. And I get this type of reconstruction result from one projection. And it's intuitively clear one projection will give us no 3D information. Can something happen along the projection rays, but we don't know where. If we get a second projection here, then we know, for instance, whether there is a value here or whether there is an attenuation happening there. So we do the second projection here, and we get this convolution result, and we do the back projection and add up the values that I have here along the lines with the values I had here along the projection lines, and I already have a square. So I have approximated now the circle by a square using two projections. Huh? What also makes sense, you know, if you have a circle and you just have two projections, what you know is the bounding box. Yeah, if you have a pool in your garden and you want to have a rough estimate what is the volume, and if you want to compute the area of the pool, you just do an embedding in a square and then you have a rough estimate. Yeah? That's how I impressed my neighbor. He bought a pool and then he was thinking, how much water does he need? And I said, maximum blah, 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 without 5 milliseconds. And he was like, woof, how did you compute that? And I'm a professor. I didn't explain to him the trick, yeah? It's just twice the radius square. Yeah? That's the way. How you can impress people. Yeah. So now we take a third one. Get this one. You smear, you get this. You smear, you get this. And now the more you have, more projections you have, then you get your cyclic structure or your cylinder if you have multiple scans. Yeah? And remember, when we intuitively introduced the concept of smearing the projection, yeah, we said, okay, if we have a proper, the right filtering operations, maybe the smearing operation is done in a way that you really carve out the object that you want to reconstruct. And we have now analytically computed how the filter has to look like by just a coordinate transform. Isn't that cool? Yeah? We had a good intuition. We had a nice picture in mind. And our intellectual background was on a level that we were able to do the derivation using coordinate transforms. The only way why this is working is because we have to convert polar coordinates to Cartesian coordinates. So now you wish to be back again in the third semester, because then you could ask your math professor when he's explaining the Jacobian and Fourier and the integral transforms, you could ask him, what is it good for? Why do I need to learn it? Yeah? It's good for computed tomography. Yeah? Very important in an aging society. So apply the filter on each detector row. What is the complexity? Well, filtering in using Fourier transforms is n log n. For each projection, I have one Fourier transform multiplication type of things, and the back projection has a complexity of number of projections times the number of pixels I have. So, and now the engineering stuff starts. Yeah. Now we have considered our first simple phantom, the circle. We have looked what happens to the projection. We were even able to compute the projection analytically. Then we did all the computations, filtered back projections. You can do everything analytically and you can show it works. Yeah? Filtered back projection works. Filtering, integration over all the rotation angles, it works. But now we come to the practical part. To the practical part means we have now to think about what happens if our signal is noisy. So our signal is supposed to be noisy. So our measurements are noisy. My predecessor, Professor Niemann, always said symbols are clean and nice. So if you do symbolic computations, everything is clean and nice. And if you start to use sensors, it's dirty. Signals are dirty. It's a dirty business. Yeah? Hornegger is doing a dirty business. That's what you should remember. Signals are dirty. Our measurements are always corrupted by noise. So we do not observe the ideal curve, but it's going up and down and up and down and up and down. That's bad. And now the question is, how does the noise affect the reconstruction result? And that's what engineers need to understand. How much is the reconstruction result affected by noise? If you have an algorithm that is analytically correct, but in each step you're applying, you're amplifying the noise, like the differentiation I have shown to you. It's basically doubling the noise. And think about having 15 steps like that, doubling the noise in each step, you can think about what's going to happen at the end of your processing chain. It's useless. So you have to consider, as an engineer, the behavior of your algorithm with respect to noise. So that was the ideal filtering answer, or filter response. If you take the analytic version, you remember with the 2 rho square root of r square minus s square, and if you filter it, you get this type of filter response. If you filter it with the inverse Fourier transform of the absolute value. If you apply now the filtering operation to this little noise that we added up to the signal, yeah, you in the back, you might think, well, it was not visible to me at all that there is noise because it was so minor, right? But if you apply the filtering operation, you see what's happening. Yeah? It's emphasizing the noise. It's here very noisy, then it's going down, and then it's noisy again. And your expectation is, like my expectation, this will not end up to be a good result, maybe, right? This will not necessarily end up to be a good reconstruction result. So if you apply this filter directly, then you run into a problem. And what we are using usually is we apply window functions for noise reduction. And let me make a few comments on this. Some of you have the signals and systems background, so that's not new for you. For the others, this might not be that clear. So let me spend a few minutes on this. If you have a time signal, and these are the function values here. You can say these values are corrupted by noise, and I replace this value here by the average value over, let's say, the predecessor and the successor, or by the average value over the two predecessors and the two successors. So I compute the average value and I replace this value by the average value. This allows you to flatten the signal by using mean filtering. Yeah, it's the so-called mean filter. And what you do is here, I don't have color. So you basically say, I'm looking at these values and I weight them with 1/3 and add them up. And by using window functions, this is one example for a window function. You have here the weight 0, here the weight 0 for all the elements, and here you have the weight 1 for these neighbors. Now you can say, I want to use more neighbors, but I want to make sure that those neighbors that are far away get a lower impact on the result. So what you do here is, for instance, you use something like this. Instead of the 0 ones, you have a Gaussian. That's what the Gaussian filter does. What you also can do, you can use the sine function, then you get a bump like this, or any different kind of windowing function. And we call these, because they look at a window of the signal and combine the signal values within the window. So we can reduce high frequencies, so high fluctuations, they are averaged out. And window functions are the cosine window function, the Shep-Logan window function. That's a special type of filter we will also end up with for filtered back projection. And how we get there, we will see in a few seconds. So what we do in the remaining 10 minutes, the filtering operation in reconstruction, what is it? We take the Fourier transform and multiply it with the V function, with the absolute value function, in frequency domain. That's what we do here, okay? And now we want to filter. We want to filter the signal before we bring it into the back projection. So the observation has to be filtered. If it's a filter like the mean filter or any of these filters I have mentioned so far, that's a convolution of the projection with the filter kernel in the spatial domain that corresponds, ring, 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 to a product of the Fourier transform. So if I take, for instance, the Gaussian filter and I compute the Fourier transform of the Gaussian curve, then I have to multiply the Gaussian curve with P and I have implemented the filtering operation on the observed signal, like the Gaussian filtering. So it's a product. It's a product, yeah? It's a product where I multiply the whole thing with HW. That's the inverse Fourier transform of the window function that we want to apply. So that's W omega times H omega times P. So this multiplied with P. And now we see the commutativity or the ordering of multiplication, the association is totally arbitrary. We can multiply here the H with the W, and we have combined the ramp filtering with omega absolute value with the filtering operation. So we can multiply these two filters and we get a Fourier transform of the final filter that does, in combination, the W absolute value and the filtering of the signal, okay, in one step. So our future implementation of the W absolute value is a combination of this ramp filtering and signal smoothing, and we all squeeze it together in one filter, okay? That's our intention here. So we squeeze it here into one filter and multiply this in frequency domain with the Fourier transform of our projection. So our new output is ramp filtering, absolute value of omega, times the filtering that does the smoothing for us. And this is multiplied with the original signal. So let's look at the rectangular filter operation here in frequency domain. This is the spatial domain representation of the rectangular filtering operation. This is a cosine weighting function. This is the sine x over x function. This is another filtering operation. So we have different ways of doing the filtering. And what is the ramp filter result? Once again, that was the way that was the result while using the projection and applying the Ramlak filtering. What was Ramlak? That was the discrete approximation or the approximation of the omega absolute value integrated from minus 1/2 to 1/2. Yeah, and that's the noisy result. And now let's combine it here with a filtering operation. And what you see here is if you combine a windowing operation with the omega absolute value filtering, then you get a signal that behaves way better. Yeah, so it's way smoother here and will, of course, result in better reconstruction result. If you apply the cosine filter, this is what you get as a filtering response. So you see the noise is higher still, but for some reconstruction results, that might be advantageous because you see here your negative values are higher, and for getting sharp edges, this might be a better filtering kernel, even if homogeneous regions are more noisy, but your edges will be sharper, depending on what you are looking for in the reconstructed image. This might be a better kernel for reconstruction. And for us, it's important to remember, noise is amplified by the ramp filter. We have seen the incredible jumps. We have to take care of it in an appropriate manner. The noise is indirectly proportional to the applied dose. That means the signal you measure in the projection depends on the X-ray dose you apply. Of course, you get way better images if you really blow in a high dose of X-ray. You get very nice images with a low level of noise. But on the other hand, we have patient care in mind. That means we just want to apply only X-ray on a level that the data that you end up with are sufficient for diagnostic procedures. So usually we have to deal with rather noisy data because we have low dose images. And noise affects the different reconstruction methods differently. So if you design reconstruction algorithms from an analytical perspective, they are all equivalent. They are all the same. If you write things in integrals and you have an infinite number of projections, they are all the same. But from a numerical point of view, and that's where the computational engineering skills are also required, our numerical math skills are required, we have to see how noise is propagated through the pre-processing or the whole processing chain of your reconstruction machine. And there is still a lot of room for improvement, I have to tell you. I mean, in our lab, we have a whole team that is focusing on reconstruction algorithms. And we are really looking into all the numerics and math, how we can deal with the problem of observing noisy data, poor data, low dose data, and how we can do a proper reconstruction, and how do we end up with brilliant reconstruction results. And just to tell you again, I mean, if you buy a CT scanner for 1 million euro, you usually don't care what type of metal is under the cover and things like that, and what the rotation speed is and things like that. I mean, these are all numbers. They affect the image reconstruction result for sure, no doubt about that. But what the customers care about is how do the images look like at the end of the day. And so reconstruction algorithms make quite often the difference. Yeah? 10 lines of code might make up the decision whether to invest 1 million here or over there. Yeah? And that's something that we as computer scientists, as image processing experts have to keep in mind all day long, that at the end of the day, the algorithms that we design might decide on selling things or not. Yeah? And you have to tell the marketing people it's not the brochure that makes the decision. It's not the brochure they make. Sinograms. We already have introduced sinograms. Take the projection lines and put them together for all the rotation angles, and then you see the sinusoidal type of structures. So this is the second most boring sinogram you can ever get. Here is again the disk, and this is the sinogram. Yeah, this is the boring sinogram. Nothing is moving at all up and down. This is the so-called Sheplogan phantom, and here you see the sinogram. Yeah, for each rotation angle 0, 1, and so on, you get this type of projection image. And reconstruction means convert this back into the original image. If you are interested in reading all about the methods we have discussed so far, once again, Larry's book is worth to have a look into it. It's extremely nicely written, and I prefer and like it very much. And Thorsten's books on computed tomography, and also Kack, Kack and Slaney. I think I pointed out the link on the web last week already, is also worth a look. And now we are equipped with all the math, and now what we are going to do next is we will look what happens now if the projection beams are no longer parallel, because our X-ray focus is a point, we have a point source. Yeah. Now Ludwig is saying, ooh. So we are leaving the orthogonal projection with a nice property that everything is linear, and we end up with a nonlinear mapping where we have one optical center and a bundle of rays. We will look into the reconstruction of that. And then we will, when we have discussed the flat fan beam,